A Martian Rover's Landiversary, and discussing the ethics of human space exploration. You're listening to Are We There Yet? The radio show exploring space exploration. Hi, I'm Brendan Byrne. Scientists and engineers here on Earth are celebrating a milestone year for one Martian rover.
Where we are now with Curiosity, 14 years later, how much we've discovered, and we're still climbing, which is awesome.
We'll speak with the University of Florida's Amy Williams about Curiosity's time on the Red Planet and what Perseverance is up to these days. Then, space exploration is dangerous and comes with risks and questions that run the gamut when it comes to ethics.
Is this risk to life and limb or to health within limits such that the risks are acceptable for the benefits that we hope to get?
We'll revisit a conversation with Jeff Kahn, director of the Johns Hopkins Berman Institute of Bioethics, about the ethics of human space exploration. That's ahead on Are We There Yet? It's been 14 years since Curiosity landed on the Red Planet. The mission had a life expectancy of just 2 years, but Curiosity has had its mission extended thanks to ingenious engineering. Not to be outdone, NASA's most recent arrival, Perseverance, has just had a recent accomplishment too, traversing the equivalent of a full marathon on Mars. Here to talk more about these milestones is Amy Williams. She's an astrobiologist at the University of Florida and scientist on both the Curiosity and Perseverance rovers. Amy, welcome back to Are We There Yet?
Thanks so much for having me back. It's good to see you online and on audio again.
That's right. Yes. We are no longer in person, but that was quite fun for those of you listening now. If you missed our conversation from Space on Tap, be sure to listen back to it. We'll put a link to it in the show notes. We were talking about finding life on Mars then. You're back here to talk about those efforts. And we have a really exciting, we're calling it a Landiversary, right? The anniversary of the landing of the Curiosity spacecraft. How long has it been on Mars?
So we have just surpassed 14 years.
That's wild.
Yes. And those are Earth years. And so it's always tricky. You have to remember 14 Earth years is about 7 Mars years. August 5th always sneaks up on me. And then we get these awesome messages from the team celebrating it. So yeah, it takes me back. I was in grad school when we landed. We had never tried using the sky crane landing maneuver before, which has ended up being successful not only for Curiosity, but for Perseverance. Revolutionized the size of vehicle that we can deliver to the surface of Mars. So yeah, I always think it's really cool to look back on all of that and then, you know, think about where we are now with Curiosity 14 years later, how much we've discovered and we're still climbing, which is awesome.
How long did NASA engineers anticipate that Curiosity would be operational for? I can't imagine they thought 7 Mars years, 14 Earth years, right?
I think that they were optimistic. So Curiosity and Perseverance both have these radionuclei generators that provide energy to our batteries. And so they were expected to have longer lifespans than the Mars exploration rovers, Spirit and Opportunity, which were solar powered. The way that we do this to make sure that we accomplish what we say we're going to with a NASA mission, but allow ourselves to do more, is define what we call our prime mission. So Curiosity's prime mission was one Mars year. So 2 Earth years. And so each time you reach the end of sort of that scheduled time frame where you said you would accomplish, you know, A, B, and C, you go into what's called an extended mission. And so then you say, all right, well, now we can do D, E, and F, right? And so we set that up for another, at this point, you know, 1 to 1.5 Mars years. And so every couple of years, we say what the next thing is that we're going to be able to accomplish within our extended missions. 2 Earth years was the prime mission for Curiosity, and now we are at 14 Earth years.
Wow, that's pretty wild. Is there any particular maintenance that you have to do? Like, I mean, if I let my car go 14 years without changing the oil, it would be very upset at me. Does Curiosity need some oil changes on Mars?
Whether she needs an oil change or not, she doesn't get one, unfortunately.
Okay.
So there's certainly like checkups and things that we can do to kind of monitor the health of the vehicle. What we do is we've tested like all the components of the vehicle. And the instruments to several lifetimes worth of like how long we expect them to be able to operate nominally. And so we keep an eye on when we're getting close to those boundaries, because we basically, you know, you don't necessarily expect that you'll be able to have this or that actuator keep working beyond that lifetime, but they are tested to multiple lifetimes beyond, you know, the original kind of intention. And so when something breaks, we find a workaround. The really classic example of this is when the drill stopped working the way that it was designed. Yeah. And JPL engineers spent, I think, a full year, maybe more, re-engineering how we could collect samples with the drill. And so, I mean, it saved a huge component of the mission that enabled us to make these really fabulous discoveries that would have been lost to us otherwise.
Is there anything that does have a finite shelf life?
So, I mean, there is a certain amount of time. And so, you know, we haven't been putting a number on all of this as our energy usage changes with the seasons on Mars and we've become more efficient in some ways. So, yes, there is a finite amount of time plutonium will decay to generate, you know, the RTG's energy source for our batteries, but we are still trucking so far. And I think that's extraordinarily exciting to see. I mean, to exceed our mission 7 times over so far, I think it's just remarkable.
I love how you mentioned, you know, at the start of this conversation that when Curiosity landed, you were in grad school. Now you are a professor at the University of Florida, doing some incredible research. So like you have learned so much about astrobiology over these 14 years. And Curiosity has learned a lot about Mars. Over those 14 years, what are some of the big things you think that you both learned about Mars and the potential for life out there?
I really grew up on this mission. Curiosity is my first Mars mission. And as a little, you know, we joke about being a little baby grad student, even though, you know, we're beyond college age years at those points. I've grown up on this mission for sure. And so I think for Curiosity, it's been about exploring habitable environments, places where life would want to live, as the vehicle climbs Mount Sharp. And we've moved through all of these, like, actually rather different environments as we've climbed up the mountain, going from like lakes and rivers. We've moved into a place where the landscape is a lot drier. We somewhat recently gathered evidence for this, basically an ancient sandstorm on Mars that is preserved in the rocks. And so there are these very distinct shapes that appear in the rocks that as geologists, we can interpret and say, oh, this wasn't from a river flowing. This was from a sandstorm. It's just building up this incredible history of this one location on Mars that we can actually use to say generalize things about how Mars as a planet has evolved, moving from a warmer, wet world to the arid, cold, dry desert that we see today. We've really started to have a much deeper grasp about what Mars was like in its infancy and how it has evolved, just from the Curiosity rover, not to mention all the other vehicles that have been sent in the meanwhile and learned even more.
You're listening to Are We There Yet? From Central Florida Public Media. I'm Brendan Byrne. We're speaking with Amy Williams, an astrobiologist at the University of Florida, about Curiosity's 14th landiversary. It has been there for 14 years, 14 Earth years. Amy, I want to talk about Curiosity paved the way with that sky crane maneuver. Absolutely terrifying.
7 minutes of terror.
It was still terrifying because I remember this. I was covering the story when Perseverance used the same method to get on onto Mars as well. But it is following in the footsteps of Curiosity. It set a distance record recently. It has traveled a full marathon, which is impressive because I've never done that myself here on Earth. But
yep, me neither. It's something to say this vehicle with no oxygen, you know, has performed a marathon.
It did take some time to do it, right? It took plenty of time to do it. But what does that say about the mission?
So number one, like pause and think about it. For those of you who have run marathons, kudos to you. You and the rover can share your ticket you get at the end. I completed a marathon. I think if I took, let's see, Perseverance took 5 years and 4 months to achieve that distance record. I would like to say perhaps in that time frame, I too could complete a marathon.
I'll set
myself a goal here, 5 years and 4 months. So yeah, so I think, you know, this speaks to the incredible engineering, how our rovers and vehicles have evolved over the years. And so just for context, Curiosity has not completed a marathon yet. I think Curiosity is around 23 miles on the odometer, so getting close. But the Opportunity rover, the Mars exploration vehicle, took 11 years and 2 months to also complete a marathon. So we actually have several marathon finishers on Mars and zero marathon finishers in the office of Dr. Amy Williams.
And here too, yes.
So taking more time, I think it speaks to the purpose of the vehicles as well. You know, Curiosity is climbing up this mountain and we're doing these like very strategic, like routine observations of the landscape in order to kind of build up a story about what we're exploring on Mount Sharp versus Perseverance. There are greater distances for us to traverse to get to our regions of interest we want to make sure we get to in, you know, the prime mission and the extended missions for that vehicle. I think that just speaks to how these mission architectures differ. One's not better than the other, but if they're able to accomplish different things. And I think it's also pretty cool to say, a marathon has been accomplished on Mars, not once, but twice now.
That is cool. And yeah, and as you mentioned, that is intentional, right? I mean, as a scientist, you don't want to send the same tool to a place, right? You want a different tool that's going to be able to do different things and find out different things about this planet, especially when we don't send things that often to Mars.
That's exactly right. So yeah, so it definitely, it's not all about the distance necessarily. We're answering different questions with these different vehicles, but it is always really cool to look back and think like, wow, in 5 years of this mission, we were able to drive that far. And that really speaks to like how the vehicles have evolved from Curiosity to Perseverance as well. The wheels are built a little bit differently to be more robust from lessons learned from Curiosity. And the way the vehicle can move and can look at the landscape and accomplish some auto navigation activities without us having to check in with the vehicle, that also enables it to move further more quickly.
I just like picture it zooming on the red planet, but that's not the case, right? It's going far, but it's not going very fast, right?
that's correct. Yeah, it is not going terribly fast.
Finally, Amy, I know it's been a bit quiet for news from the red planet, but what is kind of really interesting that's coming up in the next few weeks or months that you're keeping your eye on?
We continue to ascend Mount Sharp with Curiosity. We are past all of that interesting boxwork material that is basically this groundwater system that's been exposed to the surface for us to explore. So we are moving within the sulfate unit. We're eventually going to get up to these units that we know were formed by wind. We call them yardangs. So they've been eroded and sculpted by wind. Those we probably won't get to till the end of the extended mission, honestly. So we have a little bit longer to be exploring what I would argue is like sort of the intricacies of, like, if you're a geologist, you're like, oh yeah, this rock layer, it's really cool for this reason, right? And everyone else is like, oh, okay, that's, I'm glad to hear that you like rock so much. But we're getting into like far more geochemical detail and stratigraphic detail. So basically what the layers look like and what environments we can interpret from them with Curiosity. And so we're kind of just filling in some of those gaps right now with that vehicle. With Perseverance, we're still exploring that really ancient terrain outside of Jezero Crater. That's, you know, our best guess is 3.9, 4.0 billion years old. So the oldest terrain we've ever explored on Mars. And we are working through this area. We're trying to understand if it was built by basically asteroid impacts, meteor impacts, as this, you know, in the very ancient times of this planet, and how it's really, really messed up the rocks there, tilted them on their sides, maybe cooked them a little bit when an impact occurs. So it's a messy rock area, and we're trying to make interpretations about it. But, you know, we're exploring two different questions in two different environments, and there's always something cool going on Mars.
Amy Williams is an astrobiologist at the University of Florida and a scientist on the Curiosity and Perseverance Mars missions. Amy, always a pleasure to have you.
Thank you so much.
Still to come, are there morals behind human space exploration?
There's all sorts of protections for workers on the ground, right? There's OSHA. I mean, there are all sorts of state level protections so that people who do risky things are protected. We don't have that for space. And so it's likely to be kind of a free for all for a while. And I think that's keeping people up at night, because you'll be able to find people who will do risky things, right?
How ethics play a role in human missions to space. That's ahead on Are We There Yet? You're listening to Are We There Yet? From Central Florida Public Media. I'm Brendan Byrne. What happens if you get sick in space? Medical researchers are working to develop new technology to help when space travelers need medical attention. We'll talk about the latest on fixing people in orbit. That's next week on Are We There Yet? But for now, we're turning to a discussion on the ethics of space exploration. It's dangerous, and human space exploration comes with risks and questions that run the gamut when it comes to ethics. Someone hoping to answer those questions is Jeff Kahn, director of the Johns Hopkins Berman Institute of Bioethics. He was a guest on Johns Hopkins' last season of the bioethics podcast called Playing God. We spoke with him on this podcast earlier this year about these complex questions. Here's that conversation now. So we're here to talk about the ethics of space exploration, particularly when it comes to long-duration space flight. This is going to be a simple question, but I'm sure a very complicated answer. What ethical questions do we have to ask ourselves when it comes to putting people in space for a very long time?
So what? I mean, we have to think about, you know, putting people on top of a rocket, on top of a bomb, and sending them off into space. But that's true for all human space flight. So the question really around long-duration space flight has to do with what's different about that. And so, you know, the short answer to what's different is we can get people back from the space station in a few days. We can't get people back if we're on Mars or if we're en route to Mars. It changes the sort of the risk and benefit calculus in a way that requires a sort of a different paradigm about what we are willing to accept in terms of risk to individuals who we put in harm's way, in the sense of sending people into, you know, space counts as harm's way. The other is radiation, in very short answer, because we know a lot about radiation at the space station and low Earth orbit. We know a lot less about human health effects of radiation once we leave low Earth orbit. And there are limits on what NASA will permit in terms of how much dose, what kinds of radiation, how much people, astronauts, are permitted to be exposed to as part of their performance of duties as an astronaut, and how can we live within those limits and still carry out these long duration missions.
You mentioned that you have to weigh this kind of equation of what is the risk, you know, what is the benefit of the risk that we are putting these astronauts in? Who is the we? Who is making that decision?
So the sort of technical answer is NASA, but of course NASA is a government agency funded by the taxpayers of this country. So it has to be responsive to society at some level. But you know, the actual do we go, do we not go, based on whatever we understand the risks to be, that lives with the chief medical officer of NASA, a guy named J.D. Polk. Who gets a lot of input, but at the end of the day, he's the one who gets to decide, or needs to decide, is this risk to life and limb or to health within limits such that the risks are acceptable for the benefits that we hope to get.
The risks of early space flight were far higher than the risks of space flight now, and even in between, when there was the space shuttle missions, there was also an increased risk of space exploration. How has I don't want to say the space flight becoming more common, but we are doing it more often than we have in the past. How does that lead into this kind of risk equation you are making when it comes to putting astronauts at risk?
Yeah, I think a few things. One, you're right. There's more experience, so I think there's a higher level of confidence about what to expect and, you know, what the risks look like and how they can be managed and mitigated. But also, there's a somewhat different tolerance for risk. There was a different, higher tolerance for risk in the early days of the space program than there is now. The right stuff, right? I mean, everybody who cares about this area has read the book or seen the movie, or probably both. And it's just not like that anymore, where you've got guys riding on motorcycles without helmets and doing all sorts of risky things. And those are the kinds of people who were willing to be strapped into rockets and shot into space. It's a different metric now, and there's a different expectation, and the agency doesn't demand that people, you know, be that kind of a risk seeker in order to be part of the astronaut corps.
What role does the public play in this, Jeff? You mentioned how, you know, we we pay for NASA. We are part of that agency, right, as American taxpayers. J.D. Polk has the ultimate say, but public perception has to do with it too. I'm thinking back to the two space shuttle disasters, and the outcry of the American people for changes there. How does that public perception play into determining risk?
Yeah, I think that's a really, really good point. I think that the worry is we don't want that to happen. Of course, we don't want that to happen because of the loss of life, but it sets back the program as well. And so I think it's public perception after something bad happens. This is a little bit of a, how do we make sure that doesn't happen? So obviously we don't want the calamity of a disaster, but it also has implications for the program itself and how it, should or shouldn't go forward. I think what's really interesting about that question is we're entering a period where it's not just NASA that's making decisions about risk, right? We have private, companies who are engaging in space travel or thinking and planning about it, going beyond tourism to sending people into space, and whether they will be thinking differently about acceptable risks in a way that will push NASA to think differently. I think it's just an interesting open question.
You're listening to Are We There Yet? From Central Florida Public Media. I'm Brendan Byrne. We're speaking with Jeffrey Kahn, the director of the Berman Institute of Bioethics at Johns Hopkins University. We're talking about exploration and the ethics of human spaceflight. Jeff, is there a broad sense of ethics when it comes to spaceflight? I'm thinking of doctors have the Hippocratic Oath. Do spaceflight program managers have the same oath that they have to take to protect their astronauts?
I love that. No one's ever asked that. And I think it's a really interesting question. I think the short answer is no. Although, the people like J.D. Polk are not just, the chief medical officer of NASA, he's a flight surgeon as well. And flight surgeons are physicians. And so they are, bound in the same way that other physicians are bound. But I think beyond that, there isn't any kind of professional oath or, set of guidance that people who engage in decisions about sending people into space should feel or are bound by or should feel governed by. So interesting question. But maybe we ought to be thinking about what that should look like.
What about the astronauts? What role do astronauts play in making these decisions and determining these risk thresholds, if that's the correct term to say there? How do they play?
They have a big role to play, and they play it. So the astronaut corps is, of course, not a huge number of people, but they're highly selected. They're very smart. They're very educated. They're highly trained. So they have opinions, and they should. And they're the ones who, at the end of the day, are going to be experiencing the risks that we're talking about. There's a representative of the astronaut corps who gives input in all of these decisions and brings the view of the collective back to the decision makers. So it's very robust back and forth in my experience. I should say too, I chair one of the committees of the National Academies of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine. That it's CAMI is the acronym, the Committee on Aerospace Medicine and Medicine of Extreme Environments. So I have the honor, really, of interacting with NASA staff and members of the astronaut corps. And so it's really interesting to see the interaction that happens. Astronauts want to fly. That's, of course, why they're in the astronaut corps. But they also are, very smart, measured people, and they want to make sure the decisions about how they fly are taken carefully and that their input is reflected.
Mm-hmm. I think one recent high-profile example of that was the medical evacuation of the ISS when Mike Fink had an issue in orbit on the International Space Station. How has that particular incident played into how people like yourself and committees that you are on and NASA may be thinking about risk?
So one good takeaway there is that this was a foreseeable problem. I don't know the specifics of it, so I don't know exactly what went on. But they managed it in exactly the way that they, prepared for. What's an interesting question is, that's great. From the ISS, you can do that. What about when we're on the moon? and when we're, you know, what about when we're on Mars? And so, of course, once you're talking about going beyond low Earth orbit, especially if we're talking about asteroids and then onto Mars, you're going to have to manage these things in place. And so we're going to have the medical expertise, you're going to have the medical supplies, and you're going to have to be able to make decisions probably without the kind of support you're used to on the ground because of the length of time it will take, right, to get messages back and forth. So, you know, AI, all sorts of protocols, but it's going to be a different world as we send people further into space.
You know, finally, Jeff, you've outlined two really interesting frontiers that we are about to embark on. Humans to deep space, right? We're talking about on the moon for an extended period of time, heading to asteroids, heading to Mars, but also the rise of commercial space. We're looking at commercial space companies taking over in low Earth orbit. For you, as someone who thinks about, you know, astronaut safety and the ethics of doing this, what are some big questions that you are asking yourself as we enter this new frontier of human space exploration?
What are the commercial companies going to be willing to do that NASA has not and will not? And what do we do about that? So it's really interesting because there's all sorts of protections for workers on the ground, right? There's OSHA. I mean, there are all sorts of state level protections so that people who do risky things are protected. We don't have that for space. And so it's likely to be kind of a free-for-all for a while. And I think that's keeping people up at night because you'll be able to find people who will do risky things, right? There are enough people who want to go into space who are going to say, sure, I'll do that. Doesn't matter what the level of risk is, just, you know, show me where to sign up. One-way missions is another one. You know, when are we going to be willing to actually consider that? Knowing, you know, whatever Mars One or whatever it was called, how real or not real that was. Supposedly there were many hundreds, if not thousands, of people who wanted to do that. And are we willing as a society to say, okay, I guess it's kind of like bungee jumping with a little more risk attached to it, right? You want to strap cords onto your ankles and dive off a bridge? Okay. But it feels a little bit different than that if it's NASA. It feels a little bit more like that if it's a private entity.
That was Jeff Kahn, director of the Johns Hopkins Berman Institute of Bioethics and a guest on that organization's latest season of the podcast, Playing God. Our conversation for this podcast first aired in June. That's going to do it for this week's show. If you're not already, be sure to subscribe to the show's podcast feed so you never miss an episode. Do that on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you use your podcasts. Stay connected with this show. Be sure to follow us on social media. You can find us on Instagram and Facebook. We're at AWTY Space. And if you got an idea for a future episode of this show or you want to join us as a guest, reach out. Our email is arewetheryet@cfpublic.org. Are We There Yet is a production of Central Florida Public Media. Our producer is Marion Summerall. Editorial guidance comes from Latoya Dennis. Support for Are We There Yet comes from our listeners. Until next week, I'm Brendan Byrne. Thanks for listening.